is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Welcome to the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Sabine Pooks. Kenai Peninsula College just graduated its 2021 senior class. It also just hired a new director. Cheryl Seemers has been with KPC for a long time, most recently as the Assistant Director for Academic Affairs. She'll be stepping into the role of College Director this summer. Hey, Cheryl. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us here today.
And Gary Turner is KPC's current College Director. He's been in that role for almost 20 years. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Sabine. Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you for being here. It's so nice to have you here in the studio in person. What a treat. And as always, you can email us your questions. My email is spoux@kdll.org. That's spoux@kdll.org. And we'll be checking that periodically. So before we do anything else, Cheryl, I want to kind of give you a chance to introduce yourself to folks who don't know you. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience at KPC thus far and kind of what the bulk of your training has been in?
Sure, I'd be happy to answer that question for you. I feel like I have a fairly extensive history with Kenai Peninsula College. I actually started in the role of adjunct in 2002. I taught English courses for the college. I then eventually moved into a full-time faculty role in the Department of English, teaching writing courses, English courses, and communications. And then about 5-6 years ago, I moved into the Assistant Director of Academic Affairs. That's my current role, the one I'm serving in now. That oversees the academic operations for the college, connects with UAA in terms of accreditation, works with our programs, our course offerings, oversees adjuncts, and works with full-time faculty on what we provide for educational opportunities to the community.
How did you decide to switch from that more academic-facing role to the administrative side of things?
That was a hard decision, actually, to tell you the truth. The former Assistant Director for Academic Affairs, Paula Martin, and Director Gary Turner talked to me about administration before I went into that role. I was actually serving as department chair over our English communications and writing courses, and I was enjoying that role, that slightly administrative angle on things. And when we knew that Dr. Martin was going to move on to different paths in her educational journey as well, I considered that role. I actually got the privilege of kind of trying it out in an interim capacity to see if indeed I like that. And I did, and it was a good fit. One of the folks that works in my office likes to joke that in the first year, I occasionally look like a deer in headlights as I transition from teaching into administration, which are two very different jobs. But here at the end of it, you know, I found I've loved it. I've enjoyed it. I've occasionally taught courses. The busyness of admin sometimes doesn't allow me to do so, but when I can, I was right back in the classroom teaching. Students are definitely a passion of mine, and I think that's something that's essential in the director role. It's certainly been a passion for Director Turner, and keeping student success, student needs at the forefront of our mission is essential. So I think it's a natural transition.
Absolutely. And Gary, can you talk a little bit about your experience? So you've been in this role for 19 years, is it?
Yes.
So before that, what were you kind of doing at KPC?
Before KPC?
Before you stepped into the director role.
Well, I wasn't employed by KPC before that. You know, I retired from the Air Force in 94 and worked at the UAS Ketchikan campus for about a year and a half. Then worked at NASA in Huntsville, Alabama for 4 years, and then became a senior vice president for the largest public relations agency in the world out of Seattle, trying to work my way back to Alaska. And I saw this job open, and so I applied for it. And the Matsu College job was also open, and I applied for that. And I had my pick. The chancellor at the time says, well, which one do you want? I'm like, oh, boy. So I chose Wright. Matsu's a great place, but KPC just had a feel.
How did you make that decision? That's obviously a decision that kind of determined the course of where the rest of your life was going to be.
Yeah, I fish a lot, you know. not so much anymore, but The fishing and just, you know, when I lived in Fairbanks when I was in the Air Force, I used to come down. I called them bomber runs. Leave after work at 5 o'clock on a Friday, drag my boat and two buddies along, and drive straight through, park the boat and my pickup camper in Anchor Point or in Anilchik, and launch the boat. We'd fish until, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night, go back to the camper, sleep for a few hours, and get back in the boat, go out and fish till about 10 o'clock in the morning, the next morning, Sunday morning, then drive all the way back. And so yeah, I like to fish, not so much anymore.
Wow. That sounds really chaotic, those bomber runs. So we've been talking a little bit, we were talking a little bit before this about kind of what this next year is going to look like. And obviously COVID has upended everything and there's been a lot of online learning. Where are we right now in terms of what students are experiencing at KPC and what might things look like going forward? I don't know. Gary, do you want to start with this one?
Sure. Right now we're in the same guidance phase of phase B, we call it in the university. Pretty much very, very few face-to-face classes, mostly online or hybrid delivery. So that's for the summer. Looking at the fall, we hope that based upon case counts and CDC guidance, which is, you know, loosening up, that we'll see more face-to-face. And so and that's what we're planning for. But who knows with this pandemic? There's, you know, one real strong variant that came out of India and is now in the United Kingdom, and that has people concerned. So I don't know. We're planning. It won't be back to normal, but it'll be closer than we were for the last 14 months. So that's the hope. And I know students think they want that too. Some students thrive in the online environment. Others don't. They want face-to-face. So, and we've always been able to provide a, you know, choice to those students. And this past three semesters, we haven't been able to really do that.
Right, because you guys offer, before this, you offered a lot of programs online already.
Yeah.
So kind of at this point, what percentage of classes have, for the spring, have kind of been online?
You know, when you say online now, that used to just be, okay, you're sitting at a computer and you're doing online work. Now it can, you know, and Cheryl can address this better, but there's all kinds of modalities. So Cheryl, do you want to explain that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So pre-pandemic, KPC averaged 50 to 60% online. And for the majority of those courses, I'd say we were, when we said online, we were talking about asynchronous delivery, meaning that your course is offered through Blackboard with, that's our learning management system, with pre-recorded lectures, interactive times for students. You know, we're all probably all familiar with discussion boards and things of that nature. But it was more at your own pace, you know, with weekly assignments and other things like that. So I think the greatest shift we've seen during the pandemic is that we've increased our number of synchronous offerings. So when we say online, we've all gotten so familiar with Zoom, whether it's a Zoom platform or another platform where students can come together in an online environment on their computers. But as you know, you can see everyone. You can interact genuinely, not through just a discussion board, but you can talk with one another. So I think the number of those classes, what we would call a synchronous online delivery, the number of those increased, as well as our blended modalities, which may have time on the computer where you're working on your own, and then opportunities for either synchronous or I would say face-to-face modality. Blended seem to be a popular choice among students because you can do all of that work, and sometimes you come to campus for a two-day, you know, chem lab, because obviously there are some chemicals in that, you know, you're not going to study at home, and so you can come in and do those. We've had to innovate this year, and that's been part of the excitement and part of the fun. For example, our paramedicine program has gone to a blended modality. That means the didactic teaching is online, lectures online, learning from the instructor in that environment, and then you get to come in and practice, you know, in our simulation labs, in our physical presence. You can do that skills training. That's absolutely essential for paramedical technology.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about that program soon. But first, Cheryl, I know a lot of your previous work actually focuses on place-based learning, particularly, it seems, kind of in regards to rural places. Mm-hmm. So without kind of getting too into the weeds, can you tell us a little bit about what that means and what that means when the place we're talking about is more abstract in this virtual space?
Thanks for the question. That's great. When we're talking about place-based, we are talking about drawing your educational experiences on the richness of this place that we live. And for us on the Kenai Peninsula, my goodness, the opportunities abound. For our Homer campus, for example, we have our Semester by the Bay program that we have field internships. We are out in place. We're working with whales. We're working with otters. We're drawing on the natural resources of this place. Here on the Kenai River, we might have courses that study, you know, the river, the salmon. We have citizen science opportunities right now where we're doing beluga counts, you know, out of both campuses. So that sort of place-based experience infuses the educational opportunity. But it also infuses courses that you wouldn't think of naturally. Let's say our writing courses. Sometimes we draw on place-based practices. We draw on, at times, indigenous traditions and thinking through cultural concepts and questions. We've done work on climate change. You know, we've done work on the history of work on the Kenai Peninsula, other projects that get us engaged with the community, engaged with our natural environment, and I think draw us together and make us stronger in the process. That's kind of the essence of place-based work.
That's fascinating. And how did you get into place-based work to begin with?
That goes a long ways back to when I was working on my own dissertation, and I emphasized service learning and community engagement. So it's been a long history for me, probably 25, 30 years of looking into place-based practices as well as community engaged practices in both my research and my own teaching. So we kicked off the interview with talking about my teaching practices. I think some of that work comes out of my teaching practice and now transitions into how I look at the direction of the college administratively, because we're part of the community. We want to be part of a thriving community, and that educational opportunity that draws on place is essential to our mission.
Yeah, I was reading a little bit about the Semester by the Bay program and then the whale counting, and what an amazing opportunity for folks who are in school to get to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's very cool.
And I want to answer, you know, how does place-based work when you're in a little bit less defined environment and people might be coming in from all over the U.S., all over Alaska in particular? We both emphasize the place. Like in several projects, say we've had local entities, local nonprofits, working with our classes, talking about place. So whether you're living in Georgia or you're living in Fairbanks, you might be learning about Alaska culture, Alaska history. So I think that's important. But we also ask students to bring in the richness of their place. Some of the greatest projects I've done in classrooms, Lysana communications or public speaking, where people from different villages across Alaska were talking about a cultural practice in their area or how to make baskets. And I think place is key to how many people construct an identity or a sense of who they are, and allowing that to come into the classroom and into how we talk about education really lets us bring part of ourselves into that conversation.
You mentioned kind of where people might come from before coming to KPC. How would you characterize the current student body at KPC? Where are they coming from? Has that changed in your time, Gary? I'd love to ask to have you answer that one.
Yeah, when I got here, KPC, probably the average age was about 34, 32. And one of my goals was to try to attract the more, quote, traditional age students, you know, students from 18 to 25, 18 to 26. And the term traditional student, that's when you think about traditional student, that's the 18 to 21-year-old student that goes and attends a four-year college and doesn't have a job, isn't married. But our students, you know, probably 60%, 70%, they have at least one job. They're either married with kids or a single parent. Usually they're what's called a first-generation student, first student within their family to attend college. But we attracted those students, and I think right now our average age is about 26, 27. And we do attract students from outside, and that's, you know, the paramedic program is one. But other students, they come up for the adventure, and we have students, we call them bounce backs, students that grew up on the peninsula, and they, you know, they got accepted to go to, you know, University of Washington or Washington State, and they get there in about 6 months or a year, and they're like, you know, I really miss Alaska, and they bounce back.
That's very interesting. So you mentioned, you both mentioned the paramedic program, and Gary, we talked before about how that's kind of been, that program has been a sort of bright spot during the pandemic and how it's been a popular one. So can you talk a little bit more about why that program has kind of, you know, gained even more traction during the pandemic?
Well, there's a high demand for paramedics. And, you know, we started the program 15 years ago, I guess. And it took a while to get that through the system to be approved. And it's come a long way. You know, now it's fully accredited by a Alphabet Soup accreditation, national regional accreditation. But it, you know, it's a tough, tough program. I mean, it is really tough. It's probably the hardest program that we offer. And you have to be committed. Not everybody's cut out to be a paramedic. You're the first responder on scene, and it's God knows what you're going to see. You know, my son's a paramedic. He graduated from the first program we did, and you know, to go to a car accident and have a very badly injured child, or you know, it's. It's tough. It's hard on the psyche.
Sure. How does the program work, the paramedic program?
How does it?
Because I think you said before that there's kind of some hybrid elements to it. So how students who are from here who are taking the program, you can do this program remotely, can't you?
Cheryl can address that.
Yeah, Cheryl, could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So what we've done in the last year, we used to be an entirely face-to-face paramedic program. And so I think it just goes back to the blended modality. Like, we've put some of the lectures, the teaching online, quizzes, things that can go online. But then students are coming in to do the hands-on experience in short intensives, say, a week at a time. Do that.
Very cool. So a student could potentially be part of this program remotely, but then could kind of come for a chunk of it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We have students this year from Washington.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you talk about the innovation of it. Our instructors were asked to share at a conference, like the innovations that they've done in paramedical education. And we have state-of-the-art equipment. Our paramedic instructor calls it the whole sim family. Like, we have all the simulation equipment you need to test and do the trials and do that, but not, of course, on real patients.
Yeah, what are paramedic director and a couple others on this team, what they did was unheard of. People in the paramedic field, you know, said this can't be done. Paramedicine needs to be done face to face. And they made it work. They got it approved. And you know, I think this year we had 17 students. And typically we'd have a class of 7 to 9, and that's students from out of state.
When students from out of state come up here, whether it's temporarily for kind of a small part of a program like that, or whether it's to come to school up here more long term, do you find that they tend to stay after graduation and get jobs here? Is that something that those students tend to do? Do you have a sense of that?
A lot of it depends upon if they get a job. You know, there's research that's been done that if a student moves away from home and they go to an outside college or a college outside their own state, about 70% won't return to their area. Because they go to college and they find a partner, they get married, they find a job, and they don't come back. You know, and that's former University of Alaska president Mark Hamilton. You know, he called it the brain drain. We lose these students, and once they're gone, once they leave Alaska, not a lot of them come back because of just those things.
So I guess on the other end of that, I could see students coming up here and for the first time and kind of staying up here, right? Is that on the other side of things?
Yeah, sort of. You know, as those of us that have lived in Alaska for a while, it takes a special person to live in Alaska for all the reasons we know. And, you know, when we have somebody that might apply for a job at KPC and they're from out of state, it's like, you know, and we ask them, why Alaska? Why do you want to move to Alaska? And some of them have good reasons. Others say, well, I always wanted to see Alaska. Well, seeing it is a lot different than living here. It gets mighty cold, not as bad as Fairbanks. Summers are very short, and it can be very rainy. And usually, you'll know if a person's going to stick around if they last a year. When I was in Ketchikan, I was there for 2 years. And they, you know, and I shouldn't call it clannish, but you really weren't in an inner circle in that town until you were there for 2 years. You know, Ketchikan is tough, at least it was for many, and me as well, because of the rain. And those that lived on the island, you know, if you made it past 2 years, you're good. You're going to stay there for a while.
That's interesting.
I might add to what Gary was saying, too. For the programs we offer in those high-demand jobs, we have exceptional job placement. So when you look at our process technology and our instrumentation, our paramedic program, welding, the nursing program we do in collaboration with UAA, those students are sometimes getting jobs before they finish. Like it's our challenge to keep some of our welders like finishing out the program because they're in demand. Same with our process technology and instrumentation. They're scooped up and taken into a job before they can finish. So we do have programs that help them get through even if they, you know, achieve that job. But I think in those areas, you're especially seeing people who are staying in state because the job opportunity is right there. But I think another goal for KPC that we work hard on, as you know, for a lot of students, they come there to get their first and second year of college done, but they have every intention of going on to another college, whether it's out of state or one in our state system. So KPC is an exceptional, I'd call it launching pad for whatever the goal is for the student. They can come in, get the first and second year done. And we were talking about demographics earlier. What we're seeing is an increasing number of students that want to get that first and second year of college done while still in high school. You know, we call them our concurrent enrollment students. They're getting high school credit, whether it's through our Jumpstart program or through our newly launched middle college. And I have to brag about our counseling and advising department and those on staff who help students think about their long-term goals. Like they're looking at, where do you want to go to college? Are you going out of state? Okay, this type of program, these are the courses you should take. And so they're doing some careful advising with the students' whole life goals in mind. So
some students, as we know, just aren't ready to move away from home. Not quite mature enough. Don't really know how to study that well. So, you know, they stick around here. You know, we're small. The professors, you call by their first name. You're not a number. And those students need that. They need the encouragement, and that's what we do with our students. You know, that, yes, you can be successful. And then after 1 or 2 years here, you know, and we have some four-year degrees in conjunction with UAA that people can get here. But, you know, they can spread their wings and say, well, I want to go to Fairbanks and study Arctic engineering. Well, They got it 2 years from us. They got their first 2 years of college. They transfer within the system, and that's good. So it's like Cheryl said, you know, a launching pad.
Cheryl, you had mentioned the process technology program, and I wanted to ask about that. I'm so curious, kind of as the oil and gas landscape in Alaska changes and things, you know, are shifting always kind of within that industry where we are now. Has that program changed at all, or kind of is there a, can you kind of characterize maybe the shift that program has taken with the kind of changing landscape of oil and gas here?
Sure. I wish we had our department chair, Henry Haney, here to answer that question. He's my go-to for answers on that. I guess the best way I would say it is that enrollment it waxes and wanes, you know, so to speak. And sometimes it even depends on rumors and what's out there and where's the oil and gas industry going to go and where are we going to take it. So we'll see larger classes where there's a big push through, and then they'll be smaller. Right now we have a large number of students that are going through, I call it a larger cohort, because they want to be ready for oil and gas jobs that they are expecting in the future. So we've worked, and Gary might speak to this next, but we have worked, of course, during the pandemic. It's also a challenge because there's lots of hands-on work within these as well, especially in, we have process technology, but we also have instrumentation. And so our instrumentation is getting ready to do some really innovative work in terms of simulation that through the computer, through programs that we'll have on campus, that'll help us launch a little bit more of a statewide footprint in terms of instrumentation training. And we're really excited about that.
You know, another thing that people, I think a lot of them realize, is it's the graying of the workforce. There's a lot of people retiring from the oil and gas jobs, and they have to be replaced in many ways. You know, even though we've seen, you know, the layoffs, you know, BP left, but, you know, the other majors, and especially the support industries to oil and gas, they're still hiring. Things are slower now, but, you know, the United States is going to be dependent upon oil and gas for a long time. Yeah, you know, electric, great. Can't wait for it to become, you know, easier up here. You know, but you need charging stations and everything else. So there's a lot of logistics involved with that. But yeah, oil and gas is here for a very long time. And hopefully some of the projects they've talked about for oil, you know, hopefully some of those get approved. It's hard to say with the, you know, the Biden administration right now not being real favorable to natural resource extraction. So we'll have to wait and see.
And that's interesting what you were saying, Cheryl, about how it kind of waxes and wanes. It sounds like maybe it's not so linear or predictable which classes are going to be bigger or which are going to be smaller. Would you say that that's true?
I would say that's the case. And sometimes, you know, Gary and I both make decisions on letting classes go with smaller enrollment because we know that a smaller cohort is processing through, and that's okay. But we've always had steady offerings in process technology and instrumentation, and I expect that to be the case going forward.